northeast corner of Illinois and Georgia Streets in downtown Indianapolis today hosts the St. Elmo's Steakhouse and Harry and Izzy's restaurants, both part of the Circle Center Mall complex. However, long before any of these establishments were opened, and well before the construction of Circle Center Mall itself, this location was the site of one of the worst disasters in the history of Indianapolis, the National Surgical Institute Fire of 1892. Hello and welcome to episode 3 for Yesterday's Indianapolis, a podcast about the 200 plus year history of the Circle City. So today's topic is the Surgical Institute fire, which took place in 1892. Now, the Surgical Institute was operated by Drs. Horace Allen and Charles R. Wilson in 1892, but was actually first opened in Illinois in 1858, prior to moving to Indianapolis in the late 1860s. The Institute advertised itself as treating a variety of crippling physical diseases and injuries with a focus on orthopedic care, although a wide variety of conditions were addressed. Although the practice of medicine in the mid and latter 19th centuries was far from an accurate profession and was fraught with guesswork and incomplete understanding of the human body, along with technological limitations, the Institute proved very popular in its treatment of patients. Incorporated in 1869 here in Indianapolis, the Institute at various times had satellite locations in Philadelphia, Atlanta, and San Francisco. In addition to treating patients on site, and apparently here in the city at their location, there were accommodations for over 300 patients, the Institute also manufactured medical devices, such as splints and other assistive devices, which was actually manufactured on site for sale to not only patients that were receiving care here in Indianapolis, but also abroad at other institutions. The Surgical Institute advertised heavily, including detailed pamphlets which were available by mail order. One of these is available in the Internet Archive, and if you want to take a look at this, there's actually a companion blog post to this podcast, and it'll be linked in the show notes. But this pamphlet, which was available, as I said, on the Internet Archive, was published in 1895, and the pamphlet proclaimed on the first page that, quote, "The institution was established for the cure of the lame and deformed and of chronic diseases requiring its superior treatment." And if you look into, there's actually quite a few pages to this pamphlet, but it goes through a kind of a detailed description, along with pictures, of the various maladies and conditions that the Surgical Institute claimed it could address. So, like I said, if you want to take a look at it, check out the link in the show notes to dig into this pamphlet. So aside from the pamphlets, the Surgical Institute also advertised in local newspapers. An ad in the Indianapolis News on September 22, 1888, stated that, quote, "Parents should take their afflicted children to the National Surgical Institute, where every provision is made for their cure," end quote. The ad goes on to detail various conditions which can be addressed, including paralysis, spinal diseases, lameness, as well as tumors, ulcers, abscesses, or chronic disease. The advertisement also alluded to some disagreement between the Institute and the greater medical community. Quote, "It is thought by some persons that the Surgical Institute and the members of the medical profession are hostile to each other. This is not the case. The Surgical Institute desires no patients for treatment by its methods, which the family physician is prepared to treat." End quote. In Indianapolis, the Institute was based on the northeast corner of Illinois and Georgia Streets, a location it would occupy for over 20 years. The Institute's Illinois Street location was actually several connected buildings, with the main section being located directly on the corner of Georgia and Illinois Streets, with frontage on both streets. This section of the Institute had originally been constructed around 1856 as a three-story hotel, although later owners slapped an additional fourth level on the structure prior to the Institute taking over the property. The second section of the Institute, or the Annex, as it was sometimes called, fronted Georgia Street itself. A narrow alleyway separated these two sections, which were connected by a series of passageways and walkways. There aren't any images or photographs. Well, there are images, I should say. If you go to the companion blog post, you can see there are some engravings and illustrations of what the Surgical Institute looked like, but there aren't any photos of the time. However, if you the 1887 Sandboard map kind of details what this whole complex looked like and shows a confused arrangement with different parts of the Institute complex having two, three, or even, as I mentioned, four stories. And then the also showing the walkways between the two sections being over the alleyway being at various levels as well, including one walkway across the second story, another walkway at the third story, another walkway at fourth story. So the building itself was kind of reading the reports and reading the descriptions, you get a sense that it was kind of a cobbled together building. Obviously, there was the original structure that was constructed as a hotel, and then there were just kind of a haphazard construction of additional sections, additions to the property, the expansion to the annex where they built walkways across the alleyway to access that. Kind of a, like I said, cobbled together. So the fire itself broke out shortly before midnight on January 21st, 1892, when the Institute's janitor/night watchman, George Finn, discovered the flames. The location of the flames varied depending on the reports in the various sources. Initially, one report said that the fire was discovered in the secretary's office, while other reports indicated the advertising office, although these may have been the same room. Wherever the fire originated, the situation quickly began to spin out of control. John Wilson, the Institute's landlord and superintendent, was summoned when the fire was discovered, and he ran to grab what was called a fire hand grenade. And this was essentially a capsule of water designed to be thrown upon small fires to extinguish the flames. And if you look at like old Sanborn maps, old insurance maps of various cities, you'll see, because insurance is obviously concerned about fire, you'll see references to fire systems, night watchmen, as well as hand grenades on site. And when I first read that, I was a little confused. Why would they have hand grenades? But these are actually fire hand grenades, which were just these, and they took various forms, but capsules of water, which were designed to be thrown at the fire itself. However, by the time Mr. Wilson returned with fire grenade, the fire was reportedly too large and was getting out of control. An alarm was raised using the firebox system, which called firefighters from nearby stations. A chaotic scene greeted the firefighters upon arriving and was described in detail by the Indianapolis News. Quote, "By the time the department arrived, the scene was one to blanch stout hearts. Poor, helpless cripples were hanging on the fire escapes and in every window. The heart-rending cries of those shut in the burning building mingled with the shouts of the firemen and police." End quote. And I will say that throughout this, the reporting, they refer to the patients often as either inmates or cripples, which kind of old-fashioned language, which would not be utilized today, but I'll be giving the direct quotes from the newspapers themselves. So with the fire department on scene, as well as police responding, rescue efforts began immediately. Firefighters and police entered the building and began to extricate the patients. Passerbys also assisted with the rescue, along with personnel from the Union Depot, which is, we know today as the Union Station, and the Louisiana Street Streetcar Barns, both of which were a short distance away from the Surgical Institute. For the fire department, the blaze was the largest since the department's experience at the Bowen Merrill Fire 2 years earlier in 1890. That fire, which struck the Stationery and Book Company's building at 18 West Washington Street, resulted in the largest loss of life for the Indianapolis Fire Department in its history when the top floors of the building collapsed, killing 13 firefighters. At the Institute, efforts to save the patients continued. One firefighter, Maurice Donnelly, who was not on duty at the time, but had just left the meeting of a local social club and happened to be nearby, ran into the burning building and emerged with two children and a woman, whom he carried to safety on his back. Now, in a time before photographs appeared in newspapers, sketches, illustrations, were often used to kind of convey newspaper stories or to provide some imagery to the newspaper stories. The Surgical Institute fire was heavily covered in the local press and all the major newspapers, such as the Indianapolis News, Indianapolis Journal, Daily State Sentinel, featured sketches from the fire. And it's kind of interesting to look at all these sketches because they're all... Some of them are very similar in what they're showing, but there's all kind of a different style. Now, I located no photos of the fire scene, either at the time of the fire or its aftermath, so these sketches are the best visual evidence of the fire that I was able to locate. Doesn't mean that there's not any images out there or other illustrations, I just couldn't locate them in my research. One of these sketches from the Indiana State Sentinel on January 27, 1892 actually shows Maurice Donnelly carrying the two children and the woman out of the burning building. And again, if you want to take a look at that image, check out the show notes, look through the blog post that will be linked there, and you can see a copy of this image along with other images which appeared in other newspapers. Some occupants of the Institute leapt from the windows of the multi-story buildings in a bid to escape. John Costello, a firefighter from the number 11 engine house, or number 4 engine house, depending on the source that you're looking at, actually caught a child who was thrown from the third floor by its desperate mother. And this was another image that was depicted in an illustration that is also contained in the blog posting. Another person, Mrs. Samuel Lazarus, leapt from the third floor with her daughter Lottie in her arms. Mrs. Lazarus was severely burned across most of her body, and she suffered further injury in her fall. She was taken across Georgia Street to the Weddle House, which was a hotel located where the Omni Severin Hotel stands today, where she later died around 4 a.m. on the early morning of January 22, 1892, not long after a rabbi arrived to minister to her. Her daughter Lottie suffered a broken leg and severe burns and was taken to St. Vincent Hospital in various serious condition, as were other survivors. Firefighters and passersby continued their rescue activities using ladders to access the upper floors of the Institute or running straight into the building through its entrances. An Institute employee identified as Mrs. Thompson, who worked at the Institute's nursery, had 43 children in her charge. She sought an escape route, but found only one, a stairway which was inexplicably blocked by a wire grate. She struggled with the grate, injuring her hands in the process before she, with the assistance of police officers, managed to tear down the grate and escape the building with the children. According to the Indianapolis News, a fire at the Institute had long been feared due to the construction of the building, its haphazard updates through the years, and because of the patients housed on site, many of whom were disabled or otherwise unable to ambulate without aid. The news observed that any, quote, persons who have been through the Surgical Institute can well understand the difficulty from it when on fire. The halls are narrow and winding, and what was worse, communication between the extremes of the long building was only possible by going up and down steep staircases, end quote. Other news reports alluded to the poor condition of the building. The prior summer, of 1891, one of the Institute's chimneys had collapsed and fallen into the street below, narrowly missing pedestrians. Reports indicated that there had been no wind at the time of the collapse and that poor construction was to blame. Even before that, in October of 1878, the then fire chief, J.G. Pendergast, on the orders of the city's Common Council, inspected the Surgical Institute and found it unsafe in the event of fire. The Common Council minutes contain a detailed report from Pendergast following his inspection, and that stated that from Pendergast it stated, quote, "After carefully examining the building and surroundings, I would be compelled to pronounce the building unsafe in case of fire, and believe that in case a fire should break out, which is not improbable, there would be a loss of life," end quote. And that was from Pendergast, which, you know, his statement in 1878 turned out to be rather prophetic. So after this report, the council passed a motion ordering the fire chief to inform the owners of the Institute, along with the owners of the Grand Opera House and Metropolitan Theater, which were also inspected, that their buildings were found to be lacking fire escapes. From the minutes, quote, "that the chief fire engineer be and is hereby instructed to notify the owners and lessees of the public buildings known as the Surgical Institute, the Grand Opera House, and the Metropolitan Theater to provide ample means for escape in case of fire, as it appears from the report submitted here tonight by the chief that these buildings are not properly provided with fire escapes, and that the chief report to this body at the next meeting their reply to this motion," end quote. Dr. Wilson responded to this inspection and committed himself and the Institute to install more fire escapes on the two buildings, not only the building at the corner of Illinois and Georgia, but also the annex next door. Writing in his History of Marion County in Indiana in 1910, historian Jacob Piatt Dunn, who was in Indianapolis at the time of the fire in 1892, recollected that the Surgical Institute building was, quote, "a veritable fire trap for sound people, let alone helpless cripples, including the upper portions of several old buildings connected by narrow and intricate passages, and insufficiently furnished with fire escapes." So the general feeling, at least as the fire was happening in the days after, was that this was going to happen, that the building was a fire trap. And even, you know, with Dunn's history, nearly 20 years later, he's recollecting back to the rather dilapidated condition of the building. Rescue and firefighting efforts continued, although the rescue of the patients became the only mission. Fire chief, or as I mentioned before, the chief engineer, as the title was often called back then, Joseph H. Webster, told the Indianapolis News that when he arrived on scene, he could tell the structure was a loss. As described by the news, Webster, quote, "devoted all his efforts to rescuing the unfortunates who hung from every window with blanched faces calling for help," end quote. Many patients were rescued by the efforts of Webster and his firefighters, along with police officers and passersby. Quote, "It is remarkable that so many were saved," said Webster. "How we ever got them out, I do not know now," end quote. By 3:30 a.m. on the morning of January 22, 1892, the flames had been extinguished to a degree to allow police and members of the coroner's office to begin a search of the building for remains. Unfortunately, not all the patients had been able to escape. The Indianapolis News provided rather detailed and perhaps overly descriptive reporting on the grisly scenes of burned remains, including how two young girls were found locked in an embrace and were, quote, burned almost beyond recognition. Additionally, this Indianapolis News headlines the next day included rather dramatic headlines as well, including Holocaust at the Surgical Institute at Midnight, or another one that said, helpless cripples perish in the flames or jump to their death on the street. The news also reported that, quote, nine bodies were taken out of the main building, all burned to a crisp, end quote. Rescuers were shocked by the scenes they encountered, and, quote, those who witnessed the horror will carry the remembrance to their graves, end quote. Even as a rescue, or more accurately, recovery efforts were in progress, discussions began about who was to blame for the tragedy, with the owners of the institute being the main focus. Dr. Wilson was questioned about this and stated that, quote, there is no blame that can be attached to us. We have an electric register and can tell if the watchman fails to make his rounds at stated intervals, end quote. And of course, it was the night watchman slash janitor who had initially spotted the fire, so it seems like he was doing his duty. But Dr. Wilson continued, noting that, quote, public opinion will be against us, and so will the press. But if we were taking these poor, helpless creatures here to do them injury, it would be different. But we take them here to do them all the good we can. And then, when an accident occurs over which we have no control, we are blamed for it, end quote. Now, I don't know. I find Dr. Wilson's rationale in that statement rather ridiculous and suspect, that because we were taking these patients to do them good, to provide them medical treatment, how are we to blame for a fire? Now, if we were taking them to do some harm to them, then we'd be to blame. I'm not sure if that makes sense. But Dr. Wilson kind of, at least in my mind, continued to dig himself into a hole when asked whether the Institute had insurance coverage. Rather conveniently, he noted that I renewed my policies yesterday, but that is not what is worrying me now. I am able to stand such a loss, end quote. The news detailed a long list of insurance policies which supposedly covered the property. Whether they were recently expired or in force at the time of the fire was kind of questionable. But the main building alone had 10 policies in place worth $22,500. The other sections of the complex had a variety of policies in place as well. Unfortunately, the number of casualties began to increase, and after searchers combed the ruined building, the remains of 17 fire victims were located. The lead column on the front page of the Friday, January 22nd edition of the Indianapolis News, which was the evening paper, and the Indiana State Sentinel recorded the names of the deceased, as well as those wounded and, at the time, those missing. Because of the Institute's national reputation and its tendency to attract desperate patients from other states, the dead were all from out of state. Searchers continued to comb the ruins all day Friday and into Saturday, January 23rd, 1892. Late Saturday, a final victim was located on the fourth floor, 6-year-old Arthur Bayless, who had been among the missing. Also late on Saturday, Lottie Lazarus, whose mother had leapt from the building in an effort to save her, succumbed to her injuries. The final death toll was 19. Investigation into the cause also began, even as recovery efforts proceeded. Reports indicated the fire had spread to the dining room on the third floor of the annex, which was the addition across the small alleyway to the east, fronting Georgia Street. The fire had spread with, quote, great rapidity, end quote, to the main building, and soon both buildings were fully involved. The small room where the fire originated, when we mentioned this earlier, was described as an advertising room and reportedly housed a large amount of paperwork, such as the advertising pamphlets and circulars which the Institute used to promote its services, and unfortunately also provided excellent kindling. Although what actually caused the spark which ignited the fire remained a mystery. The walkways which connected the two buildings had been constructed of wood and not of iron, as would have been appropriate according to city officials. It was opined that if this had been done, the fire spread would have been prevented. Although considering the size of the blaze and the close proximity of the buildings, spreading the fire seemed inevitable. Even while the wreckage still smoldered and the injured were still being treated, Dr. Allen, the other physician involved with the Institute, turned an eye towards rebuilding. He stated on January 23rd that the building would be remodeled and rebuilt, and even met with city officials about his plan. The remains of those who died were taken to several undertakers and funeral homes around the city for final arrangements, and crowds gathered outside of each, consisting of not only curious onlookers, but also family members seeking information on the deceased. Over the course of the day on Friday, January 22nd, and especially on Saturday, January 23rd, the remains began to be shipped back to their hometowns. Small boxes of personal effects, often charred and burned, were sent with the caskets. Most of the remains have been identified, although the Indianapolis Sun reported that as of Friday, one body remained unidentified due to the extensive burn injuries, and the Sun reported that the same day saw the beginnings of an exodus of the uninjured patients from the city, as patients returned to their homes with the aid of family members and friends. In the aftermath of the fire, an inquest was launched by Marion County Coroner Frank Manker, a process which took 4 weeks. The Indianapolis Daily Sentinel, which was critical of the Institute's owners and Manker, reported on the process of the investigation on February 10, 1892, noting that, quote, "A good deal of testimony has been laid before the coroner, tending to show that the Surgical Institute building was a model, and that all the inmates were as safe against fire as the occupants of any other building in the city," end quote. The Sentinel continued, stating that, quote, "This is all very well as far as it goes, and if it were not for those 19 dead bodies which accumulated within a few moments after the building caught fire, it would be smooth sailing for the coroner, and he would have no difficulty in rendering a verdict such as the proprietors of the Institute are anxious for," end quote. On Sunday, February 21st, 1892, Coroner Manker issued his decision, determining that the fire was an accident, and assigned no blame to the Institute's owners, stating that, quote, "The proprietors used more than ordinary precaution for the protection of the lives and property of their patients by providing ample firefighting appliances, stairways, exits, and fire escapes," end quote. Manker further found that half of the deceased died of suffocation, while the deaths of the remaining victims, including Mrs. Lazarus and her daughter, quote, "resulted from their inability to use the means of escape provided on account of fright, confusion of mind, and the awful suddenness with which the disaster came upon them," end quote. Manker also determined that the buildings which constituted the Institute, quote, "were well provided with exits, fire escapes, and the facilities for fighting the fire, and as safe as such buildings are, which are not fireproof," end quote. Now, fireproof was a term that was, a lot of buildings have been constructed of wood, were not considered safe for fire, but fireproof was a type of building that utilized not only concrete, steel, brick, materials that were not as flammable. Does not mean that they were completely fireproof, but they were more fireproof than the wood-framed buildings. Manker continued, noting that the staff of the Institute had all done their utmost and that the various patients were generally aware of the layout of the building and the exits, although there was no written notice of the fire exits in the individual rooms, which Manker noted was a violation. So if you think to modern-day hotels, at least, and hospitals as well, on the back of the door there's always a diagram showing where the nearest fire exit was. Manker further observed that many of the dead were found in their rooms, and, quote, "few seemingly made an effort to escape, although in almost every one of such rooms, other inmates who were more calm escaped," end quote. And something that was also noted was how crowded the Institute was, that many of the rooms were fairly small and had three or four people in each one, which some of the news reports suggested this added to the confusion, where you just had, you know, people kind of packed in to these tiny, tiny rooms. So Manker's determination of no fault on the management of the Institute was not popular in the city, and he was heavily criticized in the press, and he lost his race for re-election for the post of coroner a few years later. Meanwhile, the Indianapolis Fire Department was lauded for their efforts in fighting the fire and rescuing the patients of the Institute. The department's official history described how, quote, "many of the firemen groped their way in deadly stifling smoke through narrow and intricate hallways to save the helpless cripples, and by these efforts, coupled with the efforts of those of the attendants who did not become incapacitated by fear, many who would otherwise have been lost were saved," end quote. As it turned out, the Surgical Institute did not continue operations on the site of the fire, but was instead moved to a new location on the northwest corner of Capitol and Ohio Streets, where it continued to operate. However, Doctors Allen and Wilson would apparently dissolve their partnership, as a notice appeared in the Indianapolis News on January 11, 1894, noting that Dr. Allen had no further interest in the National Surgical Institute at the location on Georgia Street. The notice was signed by Dr. Wilson. Whatever the circumstances of this breakup, Dr. Allen opened the Institute, which was now bearing his name, on the northwest corner of Capitol and Ohio Street that same year. Within a decade, the institution ran into financial trouble, which led to its closure. The remaining building was later used as a hotel, first known as the Imperial Hotel and then the Roosevelt Hotel. The buildings the Institute abandoned at the corner of Illinois and Georgia Streets were partially repaired and rebuilt and continued to be used for a variety of other tenants over the years, including as the Stubbins European Hotel starting in 1894. That hotel would have its own fire in 1945, which resulted in one fatality. By the early 1950s, the location of the Institute was a parking lot, while the buildings which now house St. Elmo's Steakhouse stood alone on the north end of the block. The site of the fire remained as parking lots until the construction of the Circle Center Mall began in the early 1990s. So that is the story of the Surgical Institute fire of 1892. Obviously, there have been other fires in Indianapolis's history, including the Grant Fire on Washington Street in the 1970s, among a few others. But this one has one of the higher death tolls. Thankfully, Indianapolis has never suffered a fire such as the Great Chicago Fire in the 1870s, or Boston had its own fire, large fire in the 1870s as well, which, you know, those fires really decimated not only square blocks, but square miles of the entire city. And Indianapolis has never actually experienced that. But we have had several significant fires, such as this one, which were not only called out the entire fire department, but also did unfortunately result in some fatalities. As I noted, that there is a companion blog post to this podcast. So check out the show notes for the link to the blog post, which is titled, quote, "A Veritable Fire Trap, the National Surgical Institute Fire of 1892. So please check that out, and thank you again for listening.